Okay, well, why don't we get started? So David told me he wasn't going to be here this morning, so he said just go ahead and introduce yourself. So I'm John Watcher, so I'm going to give the first two lectures for today. I'll talk about, I should ask first, is the mic okay? I'm going to talk about quantum computational complexity. I'm mostly intending this talk to be for people who don't know very much about the field and maybe don't even know much about classical complexity theory. I hope that for those of you who do, things will be presented at a high enough level of detail that you won't be bored to death, so I should eventually get to some new stuff that you haven't seen before, but it's mostly intended for people who haven't thought about this stuff before or haven't learned about it. I've prepared a bunch of slides. I guess I have 2 hours, and that's more than enough time, I'm sure, to go through all the slides, and there's plenty of stuff that I could have included, but I didn't, and a lot of the stuff at the end I included, but I didn't have to. There's nothing essential there. It's just a selection of topics. I'm not going to talk about query complexity, for example. I won't talk about communication complexity, Hamiltonian complexity. There's a lot of things I could have talked about. So you shouldn't interpret this as a sort of comprehensive overview of everything. It's just a selection of topics. The ideal situation for me would be that I don't get through half of them because people are asking questions. I encourage you to ask questions if there's something you want to hear about. I have a little bit of board space over here. I've got some chiclets here to write on the board, and I'm happy to just stop at any point and explain things. So please don't feel any hesitation to stop me whenever you want. So I'm going to start by saying some very simple things about computation. It's not even about complexity at this point. Just suggest that we take the following very abstract view of computation. So we think about some sort of computation as a device. So I'll call it M here. You can think of this as a computer, or it could be a computer running a particular program that's going to solve a particular problem you're interested in. Or it doesn't even really have to be a computer. We're going to put a lot of different things inside of this box here. It could actually be a protocol between two parties or something like that. It can be anything you want inside of the box. But from outside, it looks like this. It takes some input string X. It's a binary string. Maybe that string encodes some problem you're interested in. Maybe it's a matrix. Or maybe it's a collection of matrices or just about anything you could think about, a graph, any computational problem you're interested in. And it's going to produce some output over here, and I'm just calling this M of X. And that could be a function. It could be a function of X. It doesn't even really have to be a function. For example, maybe you just want to approximate something. So there could be lots of correct answers, and you don't necessarily ask for a particular one. You just want one that's good enough. Or it could even be a distribution. You want a sample from some distribution. So it doesn't have to be a function. But nevertheless, I'd like to, for the rest of the talk, restrict our attention to a very simple case, which is that not only is this, not necessarily a function, but this thing is going to be one bit. It's just going to be a one-bit answer, and we're solving a decision problem. So we have some input here, and it's going into this computation, and the output is a decision, 0 or 1. And the reason we're restricting our attention to that is, well, two reasons. Number one, it's convenient. It's going to sort of frame things in a more simple context that we can talk about. And number two, we're not really going to lose anything by making that assumption. All of the sort of complexity theoretic issues that would come up if we think about the more general setting are already going to be there in the case of a one-bit answer. So nobody is suggesting that this is the only type of computational problem you're interested in. But from the point of view of complexity, it just makes sense to make this restriction, to make the problem simple, and pretty much everything is there already. Usually the only difference between a decision problem and some function that you're interested in would be sort of some simple binary search that you just sort of tack on at the end, which isn't going to be very interesting from a complexity theoretic point of view. So a little bit more precisely, whenever I talk about a problem, computational problem, In this talk, I'm going to mean something called a promise problem, which is a sort of a type of decision problem, a particular way of framing a decision problem. This is a problem where you have two disjoint sets of inputs, yes inputs and no inputs, and you just want to distinguish those two types of inputs. So you want to output 0 or 1, depending on whether the input is a no input or a yes input. So here's a simple example, and I'm going to be returning to this particular example several times during the talk. It's just a good example to talk about. It's the graph isomorphism problem. Here, this sort of illustrates the way that we would typically express a decision problem. So the input is going to be, of course, just a binary string, like it always is, but we're going to interpret that as encoding two graphs, G0 and G1. And there's two cases. The yes cases are when G0 and G1 are isomorphic. That means that you could just take all of the labels of one of the graphs and do some permutation on them, and you would get precisely the same edge relations as you have in the other graph. So in other words, two graphs are isomorphic if they're the same, up to just changing the way that you labeled the vertices. And the answer is no if the two graphs are not isomorphic. There could be some inputs that are neither yes nor no. In this particular case, if you chose a particular encoding that you could choose a particular encoding that would just exhaust all the possibilities. Every input would be either a yes or a no. But in some cases, there could be inputs that are neither yes nor no. You think of those as sort of don't care inputs. So we can have those things in a promise problem. Many of you may be familiar with languages. If you took a course in computability theory or complexity theory, you talk about languages. And these are essentially just promise problems where everything is either a yes or a no. There's no don't care inputs. But from the point of view of this talk, it's going to be convenient to allow for these sort of don't care inputs. This allows us to phrase certain approximation problems conveniently, and we really lose almost nothing in making this generalization. A bit more abstractly, a promise problem is just a collection of two sets, the yes inputs and the no inputs, sets of strings. They have to be disjoint. You can't have an input that's both a yes and a no. And that's pretty much all it is. Now, it's quite clear, I think, what it means for an algorithm to solve a decision, to solve a promise problem. You put in the input, the algorithm does whatever it does, and it outputs a 1 if you have a yes input, a 0 if you have a no input. And we could ask, what is the class of promise problems for which there is such a thing, some computation here? Of course, we have to choose a model of computation. I'm not really going to get into the specifics. Maybe we choose deterministic Turing machines, for example, just to give a mathematical framework for talking about computation. Or we could choose other models. It turns out that we have a very good understanding of which problems have computation. This is in the domain of computability theory, and most of it was worked out pretty extensively in the first half of the 20th century. But unfortunately, it usually doesn't really help to know that there's a computation that solves a particular problem. You need that computation to be efficient. It's very easy to write a computer program that'll solve a particular problem, like factoring. Just start searching factors. The problem is that you have a particular number you want to factor, you put it into the algorithm starts running. Eventually, you lose interest in the problem, you retire, you die, sun engulfs the earth. Computation is still going. Well, maybe it stops at the last step there, but it doesn't help to have an algorithm that's not efficient. You never see the answer. So we need the algorithms to be efficient. And that's what complexity theory is all about, is trying to understand which problems have efficient algorithms. We can talk about many different types of resource constraints and notions of efficiency. Usually we're interested in time because that's the most valuable resource. We want to have answers to our questions quickly. You might also be interested in space, memory usage. Maybe you'd like to be able to solve a particular problem and not use very much memory. Maybe that's relevant in a case such as when you have a computational problem and you think of the input to that problem as being the World Wide Web. You can't store the web on your computer. So you need a space-efficient solution to solve your problem. We can think about different models of computation. Deterministic computation, well, that's pretty much the way you would think of your desktop computer. just runs from one step to the next. It doesn't use any randomness. It just follows an algorithm, solves a problem. There's models of non-deterministic computation, probabilistic computation, where you use randomness to help you. And of course, quantum models, that's the point of this workshop. So we can talk about all of these different kinds of things. We can make it more abstract and think about the thing inside of this box here not being necessarily a computer running an algorithm, but it could be an interaction among, say, two entities. And maybe we assume that those entities have different goals. Maybe they're competing goals. And maybe a situation in economics might be relevant where you kind of assume that everybody is being greedy, and you know, this leads to some solution. Vijay? Well, okay, non-deterministic means something specific in the context of complexity, and I don't want to spend too much time on that. I'll talk about the class NP, and this is a notion that's captured by the class NP, where essentially you imagine that there's sort of some guessing going on, and you make some assumptions about those guesses being correct, or those guesses being chosen optimally. And it's kind of a way of phrasing notion of verification of proofs, and I'll get into that later. So non-deterministic doesn't actually mean not deterministic. It means something specific. But we don't really need to worry about that for this talk. Okay, so let me start by this discussion of complexity by mentioning a sort of simple abstraction. We have to have some definition for what it means for an algorithm to be efficient. And we just choose a very simple way of defining that. We say that an algorithm is efficient if the number of computation steps it runs for is upper bounded by some polynomial in the length of the input. So for example, if the input has length n, an algorithm that runs in time n cubed is considered a polynomial time algorithm. And we define a complexity class P accordingly. It's the class of all problems that can be solved in polynomial time on an ordinary deterministic computer. So I'm writing deterministic Turing machine here. Anytime you see Turing machine, if you prefer, just substitute ordinary desktop computer with as much memory as you need. Go to the store and get more memory whenever you need it. Memory is cheap. Sometimes people have a problem with this notion. I mean, a polynomial time algorithm is not necessarily efficient. If you have an algorithm and it runs in time n to the 1,000,000, that's a polynomial time algorithm. And nobody would ever claim to you that that's truly efficient. But that doesn't matter, because what we're trying to do is to understand the distinction between polynomial time algorithms and exponential time algorithms. An algorithm is an exponential time algorithm if it has a running time that's bounded by 2 to the p of n for some polynomial p. And we define the class exp, or sometimes exp time, to be the class of all these problems. So while it's true that an n to the 1,000,000 algorithm is not efficient, nevertheless, you have to put the problem into the right sort of scope. An astronomer doesn't measure the distance between galaxies in centimeters, right? I mean, you look for something that reflects the nature of the problem you're looking at. And this is the distinction that we're trying to understand, polynomial time versus exponential time. You can think of an exponential time algorithm, at least when you're talking about ordinary computation problems that you want to solve in real life, in practice. You think of an exponential time algorithm as being an exhaustive search. You don't have any structure of that problem that you can make use of. You're just trying all the possibilities, something like that. So think of it as, you know, a non-clever solution to a problem. It's just something brute force. A polynomial time computation, on the other hand, even if it's n to the 1,000,000, usually it's n squared or n cubed or something like that. But regardless of what it is, the fact that you're able to have this polynomial time algorithm means that somehow you're avoiding this brute force combinatorial search, this sort of brain dead way of doing it. You have some sort of structure of that problem that you're making use of. And it usually happens that when we have a polynomial time algorithm for a problem, the exponent starts to come down and down as people sort of hammer away at it and make it more efficient. But that's in the domain of algorithm design. and we're not really worried about that. We're worried about the distinction between these two classes in complexity. If you wanted to, you could sort of make this a more fine-grained notion and talk about n-squared algorithms, n-cubed algorithms, n-fourth algorithms, but this problem is hard enough. You're just making the problem harder on yourself. Let's try to understand this first. We're nowhere near understanding this distinction. So it's known that these two classes are not the same. That shouldn't necessarily come as a surprise. But the more you learn about complexity, maybe the more of a surprise it is. This has been known for quite a long time, I guess about 44 years. Let me define a few more complexity classes just so that we have sort of a landscape that we can work in. It's also interesting to consider algorithms that make use of randomness. And we define two complexity classes based on this notion of randomness. We can define more than two, but in particular we can define these two. The first class is BPP, and that stands for bounded error probabilistic polynomial time. This is a class of all problems that you can solve if you have a computer that has a random number generator, and it runs in polynomial time, and it gets the correct answer with probability at least 2/3. There's nothing special about the number 2/3. If you want to substitute 5/6 or 99 over 100, that's fine. The important part is that it's some constant, and that constant is bigger than a half. So what that means is that if you run this algorithm not very many times, you're going to gather enough statistical evidence to make a decision, and you'll be correct with an overwhelming majority of the time. Another class called PP, probabilistic polynomial time, sometimes call it unbounded error probabilistic polynomial time, is defined similarly, except you relax this condition on the acceptance probability. You say as long as this thing is correct with probability bigger than half, you're happy. That's not a very practical notion, because you could have a computation which would be correct, and the probability that it's correct is 1/2 plus something exponentially small. So even if you run this thing you need to run it exponentially many times before you could actually see this bias. So for example, imagine that you took some hard search problem like, say, graph coloring, which is a difficult problem. One algorithm that you could run for that is to say, okay, I'll just guess a coloring, and if it works, then I'll say, great, the graph is colorable. Otherwise, I'll flip a coin. So this would be an algorithm that would be correct with some tiny probability higher than a half of being correct, but it's just not really useful for practical computation. But it's nevertheless interesting to talk about this class, because this class somehow contains a lot of interesting problems, captures some notion of problems that you can solve by counting things. So we define this class, and you shouldn't think of it as a practical notion of efficient computation, but it's interesting nevertheless. It should be a constant that's bigger than half. It doesn't actually need to be a constant. It could be 1/2 plus 1/1 a polynomial. That would be enough of a deviation that you could notice it. The point is that you want something that you can run this algorithm a polynomial number of times, take a majority vote, and you should see the correct answer with a very high probability. These are classes. That's a good point. These are classes of problems, not classes of algorithms. We don't talk about the algorithms. We talk about the problems.
But it seems that it's not just a probability of problem, because first you have a statistics problem, and then you have a statistic encoding, and the way you encode your problem is important. If you encode your problem right back, then any problem can be.
Oh, well, I mean, that's another good point. I mean, formally, when we talk about a problem, we're just talking about two sets, the yes inputs and the no inputs. It's a set of strings, and you haven't made, it's just abstract. You don't even think about...
Yeah, but if I ask you, for example, the problem of multiplication of two numbers,
you, you raise a good point, when you talk about a real problem that you want to solve, implicitly there's some way that you have of taking that input and encoding it as a binary string. If you choose to represent your numbers the way that, you know, kids write on the dartboard when they they keep score, like one little notch for each, that's a terrible way to encode a number. And actually, if you encode a number like that, well, there's a very simple polynomial time algorithm for factoring, right? I mean, because the representation is so large. For every problem that we care about,
this representation is not a trivial problem, because you may suggest, you may say the representation I have chosen is very bad and you have a good representation. But to make that representation, you may need to solve a hard problem to represent the problem I have that is encoding. It might be itself a hard problem.
Yeah, okay.
Problem,
but I understand your point, but I want to try to answer it, which is that abstractly speaking, the definition of the problem includes the encoding. It's just and when you talk about a problem like graph isomorphism, I didn't tell you how you encode the things, but you make an assumption that you encode them intelligently. And I claim that if you choose an intelligent encoding of graphs and somebody else in the room chooses an intelligent encoding, we all choose an encoding. We may all choose different ways of encoding, but it's going to be absolutely trivial to switch between all of them. Simple polynomial time computation will switch between all those encodings. Almost always, there's just some simple, natural way to encode things intelligently, and we make that assumption, and we don't talk about it because it's simple. I mean, if you choose to represent a graph by an adjacency matrix, somebody else chooses to represent a graph by a list of nodes and the edge relations between them, I can write down a simple algorithm that will switch back and forth between the two. That'll be a polynomial time algorithm. And none of these classes will be sensitive to that distinction.
Yeah, I'm trying to understand that better. But someone may represent that to the proof. And then it might be very easier to say whether this
proof. Okay, so I mean, here's an example. Somebody, if they wanted to, could decide that they're going to represent graphs as circuits, and you input to the circuit the number of a vertex, and it outputs for you a list of its neighbors. And well, there could be an exponential number of vertices because you in some polynomial number of wires, you get an exponential size graph. That would be an extremely compact way of writing a circuit. If you're talking about a computational problem where, you're working with graphs in this representation, well, you better make that clear. And you're going to get exponential time complete problems when you work with graphs encoded in that way. That's not the way that we encode graphs when we're just, the default way of doing it. Every problem has, sort of these extremely compact encodings like that. But there's going to be problems there too, right? I mean, you're not going to be able to get every graph compactly. But let's just make an agreement. That's not what we're talking about. We're just talking about normal people encoding things in a normal way, okay? But let's make that assumption. I mean, this is an issue, and it's usually sort of, a short discussion at the beginning of the class, and then, you kind of just say, okay, let's decide. We're going to be reasonable from now on. Okay, so the last complexity class I want to define right now is P-space, polynomial space. As I said before, we're usually interested in the amount of time things take. We can also talk about the amount of space things take. So if you restrict your computation to run in a polynomial amount of space, polynomial amount of memory, then you get this class of p-space problems. That's an enormous class of problems, and the reason is because you can reuse space. You can have an exponential time computation that runs in polynomial space. And surely anything that runs in polynomial time must run in polynomial space, because you don't have time to use more than a polynomial amount of space. So here's a diagram of the classes that I mentioned so far. And this is a sort of diagram that I'm going to be putting up several times through the talk. Actually, I'll just be kind of building up this one. So just so that it's clear and you understand how this type of diagram works, it's a so-called Hasse diagram, where these things are just subset relations. So if you can get from one point to another by going up, or going vertically, then you have a subset inclusion. So for example, P is contained in BPP. That's trivial. If I have a deterministic computation, I can think of that as a randomized computation where I just didn't bother using the randomness. BPP is contained in PP. That's trivial because all PP is, all BPP is a restricted version of PP just by definition. It's immediate. The one inclusion on this slide that's not really so obvious is PP contained in P space. If I have a computation that runs in polynomial time, I use randomness. I can simulate that in P space. The way I'll do it is I'll just iterate through every single possible setting of the random bits. And I'll just make sure that I do this in a space-efficient way. I'll do a simulation for a particular setting of random bits. I'll get an answer. I'll keep a score. Did I say yes or did I say no? Then I'll go to the next setting of random bits, and I'll reuse the space I used for the original simulation. And then I just finally get to the end. It's going to take exponential time. That's okay. It's going to run in polynomial space, and I'll get the right answer because I can just count. I can see, was the probability bigger than a half or smaller? Just look at the tallies. And P spaces contain the next. That's not too hard to see because if you have polynomial space, just count all the possible configurations you could ever have at the most exponential. So you may as well just attach a clock to your machine that turns it off after an exponential number of steps. Because if you're still running at that point, you must be stuck in an infinite loop because you hit the same configuration twice. Okay, so we're halfway through already, and we haven't talked about quantum anything, so I should say something about quantum computation. I wasn't here yesterday, so I don't know exactly what you've learned and what people's background is. I'm going to go pretty quickly here, just to make sure that we have the model right. When we talk about quantum complexity, we usually work with quantum circuits because it's the nicest model to work with. And when I'm talking about a quantum circuit, I just mean more or less what you think I mean, I guess. It's just a sort of a network of gates, and they're connected by qubit wires here. I don't require my gates are necessarily unitary. All I require is that each of these gates is a little tiny, completely positive trace-preserving map. It's a quantum channel. Did you learn about quantum channels yesterday? If you want to restrict these things to be unitary, you can do that. It doesn't matter. You're not allowed to have any sort of cycles in this thing. It has to be acyclic. You have a bunch of inputs over here. You have a bunch of outputs over here, and that's a quantum circuit. To define things correctly in the context of complexity, we can't allow just completely arbitrary gates. We have to choose a set of gates. Excuse me? How do you define what's good?
How do you say that this model is better than that one?
How to answer? I mean, it's an opinion. I mean, I say it's best. That somebody else could prefer a different model, but they don't. Another natural choice is quantum Turing machines. They're hard to work with. Quantum circuits are easier to work with. Some people would choose a different model, but most people, just about everybody, works with the quantum circuit model. So we're going to pick a fixed set of gates that we're going to allow our circuits to be built out of. I think you've probably seen these two things yesterday. I hope so. Or I don't see any vertical movement like this, so it's bad. All right, well, these are two examples of quantum gates. Toffoli gates, Hadamard gates, phase shift gates. I'm not going to be necessarily working with these things specifically. Well, I'll mention maybe a little bit, but it's not essential that you have familiarity with these things, but just understand that these are very common choices of quantum gates. And these three gates here are pretty much enough to do any kind of quantum computation you want. I'm going to throw in two extra gates. Call this one an ancillary gate and call this one an erasure gate. They're sort of a little bit grayish here because they're non-unitary gates. These three guys are unitary and these two guys are non-unitary. They don't even preserve the number of inputs and outputs. And these are really simple. They're not actually all that useful for computation, but they are useful for just phrasing things in a convenient way. An ancillary gate just means you go to the refrigerator, take out a fresh qubit, and you're ready to use that. You don't have to consider that thing to be an input. You can consider it to be something you used along the way in your computation. An erasure gate just means take the qubit and throw it in the garbage. Of course, these things are absolutely not important at all for actually computing things, right? Because if you want, you just take you know, all of your ancillary gates and just sort of stretch them out to the beginning of the circuit and just imagine they come in as zeros, and take all your erasure gates and stretch them out to the end, and you don't really need to throw things away. You can just leave them there and just ignore them at the end. So they're not actually useful for computation, but they are kind of just useful for phrasing things, for thinking about the real inputs and the real outputs of the circuit, and just imagining that inside you have these sort of fresh qubits and throw things away and so on. So whenever I mean a quantum circuit, whenever I say a quantum circuit from now on, I mean a quantum circuit that's composed of these five gates. And this is a universal set of gates in a particularly strong sense. And what it means is that if you take any quantum operation or quantum channel from, say, n qubits to m qubits, so some completely positive trace-preserving map from n qubits to m qubits, and you pick some accuracy that you would like, then there exists a quantum circuit that's made out of the gates that I just showed you that comes with an epsilon of approximating this channel here that was originally given. I don't want to define to you what exactly I mean by epsilon approximation. There's a specific way that we do that. It's not important for this talk that I get into that. But suffice to say that if you have some epsilon approximation, it means that, you know, if you plug in this approximation in any sort of physical process, at the end your probabilities are going to deviate by most epsilon from what you would have gotten from the original thing. That's one way of saying it. And you can actually say something a bit stronger, which is that you can take this approximation to scale very well with respect to epsilon. You don't need the size of Q to be more than some polynomial in the logarithm of 1 over epsilon. So you can think of that as meaning that if epsilon is, even if it's pretty small, something exponentially small, you can still get a good approximation with a polynomial amount of overhead. Now, I didn't say anything here about the size having to do with N and M, and that's because I can't. I mean, in general, the circuit might have to have size that's exponential in N and M. There's absolutely no way around that. Basically, just a simple measure theoretic argument tells you that. The space of all mappings is enormous. And if I just imagine sort of dividing it into little circles, I put it like epsilons around everything, and I count the number of those things I actually need to cover everything, it's going to be exponential. I can't have a good scaling with respect to N and M, but at least I can have a good scaling with respect to epsilon. That's sometimes called the Soloveitchikov theorem, and I'm just sort of incorporating that into some general theorem calling the universality theorem. It's not a conventional term. I'm just giving it a name for the purposes of this slide. Okay, so now let's give a quantum version of polynomial time computation or efficient computation. When we talk about quantum circuits, we have to talk about families if we're interested in computational problems, because one circuit has some fixed number of inputs, some fixed number of outputs. And if we want to address a general problem, we have to imagine that there's one circuit for every possible length of an input. So to do this, we talk about families of circuits. So let's let Q be a family of circuits. It just means that there's one circuit for each possible length of an input. And we think about this circuit as being a polynomial time computation by saying, well, it has to be, number one, that these circuits have no size that's polynomial. The number of operations is polynomial. But moreover, it has to be sort of efficiently generated. You have to have a classical algorithm that would spit out a description of these circuits. So if you gave that algorithm, that classical algorithm, a description of the input n, and you ask it to produce for you the nth circuit, that should be a computation that runs in time polynomial in n. This means that you can't sort of smuggle difficult to compute information into the description of the circuit. You can't sort of hard code really difficult stuff into that circuit. They have to be efficiently describable. So if we have such a family, we can think of that as representing a polynomial time quantum computation. And if you did choose to work with quantum Turing machines, this would be an equivalent notion to, you know, a quantum Turing machine running in polynomial time. If we want to run this algorithm on a particular input x with length n, what we do is we just go and select the nth circuit in our family, and we just imagine that we take this input and we plug it in and we run this thing, and whatever we get as an output here, we measure it in the standard basis or a computational basis, and that's the output of our algorithm. So in this picture here, I've got lots of outputs. I guess if we're talking about decision problems, it's one qubit of output. But you can define this thing more generally for any number. And as kind of a shorthand throughout the talk, I'm going to just write Q of X or a variance on that sort of thing just to mean the output of this algorithm. In other words, you know, I look at X, I look at its length, I take the nth circuit, if n is the length of that input, I run it, I measure the output, and I get this thing. It's just sort of a shorthand that's going to save us some time. In general, this is some sort of random variable or a string-valued random variable, because if I ran this quantum computation, I measured the output, well, it's going to be some distribution over strings. Okay, so now let me define the complexity class BQP. So this is the most important complexity class, and maybe I should make a qualification. It's what I say is the most important complexity class, and everybody agrees with me. So it stands for bounded error quantum polynomial time, because, as I said, we equate this notion of let me give you the definition first. So we say that a promise problem is in this class BQP if there is a polynomial time uniform family, as I just described. In other words, what you can think of as being a polynomial time quantum computation that has this behavior. If you give this thing an input string that's supposed to be a yes input to your problem, then if you run this thing and you measure, you're going to see a 1 with probability at least 2/3. It's going to give you the correct answer with probability at least 2/3. And likewise, if you have a no input from this thing, it's going to give you the correct answer, which is the output 0, with probability at least 2/3. And just as we had for BPP, you can substitute a wide range of constants for 2/3. Nothing special about 2/3. 99 over 100 works just fine. And you can prove that in exactly the same way as you would the classical algorithm. If you give me a family of quantum circuits that has this behavior here, and if I'd like to change this 2/3 to 99 over 100, I can just take your description of these circuits and then create a bunch of new circuits which would effectively just run your circuit some large number of times and take the majority vote. And I'll put the answer. And that would, if I ran this thing enough times, I would gather enough statistical evidence to be correct with probability 99 over 100. Okay, so the natural question to ask is how BQP is related to other classes. Well, that's one natural question to ask. I suppose other natural questions include, you know, what kinds of problems are in here. And I think you've heard about some of these problems yesterday, factoring, for example. This is one relation that we can prove about how this class relates to others. So surely BPP is contained in BQP, and BQP is contained in PP. So this first containment here is really simple. If you believe this universality theorem, there's almost nothing to prove, because if you give me a polynomial time randomized computation, so it's you can think of that as just an ordinary deterministic computation with some random bits thrown in there, well, I can represent that as some Boolean circuit with ANDs, ORs, and NOTs. I can simulate those ANDs, ORs, and NOT gates with quantum gates, because those are special cases of quantum channels. They're just really simple quantum channels that happen to be classical. The universality theorem tells me I can simulate those things. And it's actually quite easy to do it directly with no error using the gates that I showed you from one of the previous slides. You can also simulate the generation of random bits. Just do a Hadamard transform. And if you want, you can sort of put in some noise to make it a truly random bit. And you don't even really need to do that. So it's quite easy. And that's as it should be, because we don't want a quantum model that's somehow weaker than the classical model. That doesn't make any sense. Quantum model is at least as strong as the classical model, for sure, if it's defined properly. This other containment here, BQP contained in PP, is not so simple. There's a couple of different ways that you can prove that. I'm not going to get into the specifics of either of them. There's essentially two proofs. And the first proof, I think of that as sort of being the intuitive proof. It's kind of a more or less direct simulation where you're somehow simulating the interference that you could get in a quantum computation through the use of an unbounded error probabilistic computation. So imagine doing something along the following lines. You imagine you have this computation, and you just guess a computation path. And then you compute what is the amplitude of that path. And then guess another one. And let's just hope that it lands in the same place. Now compare the amplitudes, or compare the phases. If they're the same, you would be inclined to think that there's probably constructive interference that's going to help you reach this point. If they're different, you would expect there's destructive interference that's preventing you from getting to this point. If you got unlucky and you didn't guess paths that led to, say, you know, answering some particular thing, or if you guessed two paths and they didn't lead to the same place, well, you just flip a coin. Say, I don't know. If you do this right and you choose your biases just right, you can actually make it such that, you know, if the quantum computation would have accepted with probability, would have said yes with probability 2/3, then your classical probabilistic computation will say yes with probability, you know, 1/2 plus something exponentially small. And in the other case, you would say yes with probability a little bit smaller than 1/2. So the point is, you're somehow using this fact that you can kind of just give up and randomly guess to help you simulate this interference. There is a more abstract proof which has the nice property that it's much more general. You can apply it to other classes, which basically boils down to saying that in some particular way, PP computations can perform matrix multiplications on exponential size matrices if they're defined in the right way. So this goes through something known as a gap P function. Some way represents a probabilistic polynomial time computation. So now here's our diagram of classes. BQP is just wedged in between BPP and PP. So of course that implies that BQP is contained in P space. You could show that directly if you wanted to. Of course BQP is contained in exp. That's actually quite easy, right? If you wanted to, you just write down the entire state vector, do the matrix multiplications for each of the gates. That would be an exponential time algorithm. If you wanted, you could do that space efficiently, because you can do matrix multiplications in a very space efficient way. But anyway, all of this stuff is implied by the fact that BQP is contained in PP. I guess I forgot to mention, I should have mentioned on the previous diagram, that if you're new to complexity theory, there's some bad news. I told you that P and X were different, and that we've known that for 44 years. The 1965 paper of Hartmann and Stearns proves it's known as time hierarchy theorems, which implies that P is different from X. So, if you look at each of these lines here, at least one of those has got to be a proper containment. And we can't prove that any of them are proper. So one of them is proper, we don't know which one. Maybe they're all proper, but we don't know, we can't prove any of them are proper. We don't know if P is different from P space, which is ridiculous, a ridiculous state of affairs. But we just don't know. We don't know if BPP equals X. Maybe this use of randomness can allow you to solve exponential time computations. It's completely ridiculous, but we can't rule that out. A lot of people think that P is equal to BPP and that the rest of the containments are proper. That's sort of a running conjecture. But if you can prove any of these, you win the Turing Award, the highest honor in theoretical computer science. Question?
What do you mean by one of these proper?
Okay, so P is properly contained in exp. It's a proper subset relation. So one of those containments has to be proper, and we don't know which. No? I mean, it's a theorem. There exists a problem in X which is not in P.
So, okay, so you're saying there exists a problem?
I mean, you can't assume it by definition because, I mean, for all you know, it could be that if somebody tells you, here's a problem that's in exponential time, it's an exponential time algorithm, how do I know that there isn't a better algorithm? The proof is by diagonalization, which is, you know, like proving there's uncountably many reals. Same idea. The way that you do it essentially is you say, okay, I'm gonna construct a really artificial problem. It's gonna be in exp and it's not gonna be in P. And the way that I'll do that is somehow the definition of the problem will say something like, well, have to do with sort of the behavior of all of the Turing machines that run the polynomial time, and then answering the opposite. And you can do that simulation in exponential time, and it has to be not NP because otherwise you would get some contradiction. So there's no natural problem that we have we can say definitely is an exp and it's not NP. It's, well, it's because you construct these artificial problems. But actually, you know, if you have a problem that's complete for exp, it can be natural. Something like, you know, generalized, like n by n go, does black have a win from this position? That's exponential time complete, as long as you define the rules correctly. You can prove that's not NP, but it goes through this diagonalization argument. Part of the issue here is that when we're comparing P and X, it's one resource, time. What we have trouble with is relating two resources, time and space. Randomness, quantum, whatever. We don't know how to relate different resources. Okay, I should speed up a little bit, I think. So next I want to talk about NP and this notion of efficient verification. Again, I'm sort of switching back to talking about classical things for just a minute, but then I'll eventually generalize them and talk about quantum things. So for a lot of problems that are of practical interest, sort of combinatorial optimization problems, it's possible to efficiently verify when you have a correct solution, but it's, as far as we know, difficult to find that solution. This class NP, which stands for non-deterministic polynomial time, formalizes that notion. So you see that our promised problem is in NP if there exists two things. First, some polynomial P, and that's going to be a bound on the size of a particular thing that we're going to think of as a proof that the answer is yes. The second thing is a polynomial time algorithm, which we're going to think of as a verification procedure. And these two things should satisfy the following properties. The first one is called completeness. So if you have a yes input to your problem, then there should exist a string y that convinces you that that's so. The string y has to have length that's at most p. This p here is the length of this string y. You plug x and y into your verification procedure and it says yes. One, I believe it. Think of it as a verification of a proof. Y is a proof that X is in the yes inputs. Completeness term comes from logic. It just means you can prove things that are true. The second condition is soundness. It means you can't prove things that are false. If you have a no input, then it doesn't matter how devious you are. No matter what kind of proof that you come up with, that's supposed to convince this verification procedure that X is in the yes set, it's not going to work. You plug in that string here, and it's going to say, no, I don't believe it. So it's really like a verification of a proof, at least in a computational setting. So here's an example, going back to the graph isomorphism problem. Suppose that I give you two graphs, and you want to prove to somebody that those two graphs are isomorphic. How do you do that? Okay, we don't have an efficient algorithm that solves this problem. But let's suppose that you go back to your office or wherever, and you think about this problem for 10 years. It's not going to take you that long for this particular example. And then you want to come back and you want to convince somebody that these two graphs really are isomorphic, so that this is a yes input instance of this problem. How do you do it?
Can you randomly choose one node and corresponding node in the other graph?
Well, you're giving me an algorithm, and that algorithm is probably not going to run in polynomial time. But, I mean, here we're asking for something less, which is just a verification. So I don't care how long it is that, it, you know, you can take as long as you want, exponential time if you want, to find this proof. But as long as that proof is short and somebody else can verify it quickly, then that's enough. So what I'm looking for here is that you just write down the isomorphism. For example, I just tell you how to change the labels here to get the right edge relations over here. So if I write down this isomorphism, which is not long, it's going to be polynomial in the size of the graph, polynomial in the number of vertices, then you can just check it. You just replace the labels as given by this isomorphism, and then you just check to make sure that all the edge relations are right. That's going to take you polynomial time as well. There's only n squared edges. Or only n squared pairs of vertices, I should say. So you can all check it if you want. If everybody randomly chooses two vertices over here and over here, check and make sure the edge relations are right, then you know, if nobody says, hey, wait a second, in the next 10 seconds, then we know that the graphs are isomorphic, right? Okay. Now, one question you can ask is if this class NP is closed under complement. In other words, if I switch the S's and the N's, do I change the class? Yeah. Well, it's just to answer yes or no, is there a permutation? Right? Oh, well, there's an exponential number of possible permutations, and if your algorithm is to search through all possibilities, you could write down all the possibilities and then sort of say, well, you know, none of them worked. That's not a good proof. Or that one of them worked, it's not a good proof. It's not a good algorithm. But, you know, you can kind of think of this, you know, the selection of this proof as being something that's all kind of offline. You're not accounting for the resources required to find it. It's just, can you verify it? It's almost just like a proof of a theorem. I mean, it takes years to prove theorems. And then hopefully somebody writes a paper and then other people check it and it takes an hour. Or depends on the proof, I guess, but that's kind of the idea. You don't worry about how long it took you to find the proof. You just worry about how long it takes you to check the proof. That's what the class NP is about. It doesn't represent a class of efficiently solvable problems. What it represents is a class of problems we wish we could solve, because lots and lots of problems are in this class. Question? Well, I mean, kind of just goes back to our assumptions. I'm just saying, for the sake of classifying this problem, it's enough to just say yes or no. And if you had an algorithm that would do that, it would say yes or no, and it wouldn't actually give you any information, then I claim that you could actually use that. You could use that algorithm to find an isomorphism, and what you could do is you could sort of imagine just sort of attaching little, you know, weird little graph gadgets to different vertices that would, you could answer yes or no, and you could effectively do some sort of binary search for a good permutation. But the way that I've defined the problem, we don't care. We just want yes or no, and that's enough. Okay, so let me talk about this idea of swapping the yeses and the nos. Suppose we do that. So here I've defined the graph non-isomorphism problem. So the only difference here is I've just switched the two conditions here. You're supposed to say yes when the graphs are not isomorphic. Okay. From the point of view of answering the question and having an algorithm for it, it doesn't really make any difference. Of course, you can just flip the answer at the end. It doesn't do anything. But with respect to this class NP, it makes a big difference. Because what you're asking for here, to know if this problem is in NP, you want to have a way that somebody can write down for you an efficiently verifiable proof that two graphs are not isomorphic. Okay, because it's not symmetric, right? The completeness and soundness conditions are not symmetric. So suppose I give you two graphs, and I tell you that they're not isomorphic. And you want to convince somebody that they're not isomorphic, and you want to do that efficiently. How do you do that? Obviously, you can't write down an isomorphism because there isn't one. You can't say, well, you know, I spent all day, I searched through all the isomorphisms, possible isomorphisms, and none of them works. Because you could lie. You could be lying, right? It's not going to satisfy the soundness condition. You would be convinced that two graphs that are isomorphic, in fact, are not, if you believe such a proof. So let's think about these two graphs. How would you prove to somebody that they're not isomorphic? I claim that they're not. I mean, you can't just sort of look at the edges and count the number of vertices. That doesn't work. Look at the vertices and count the degrees. I mean, they both have five vertices of degree 2 and two vertices of degree 3. So that's not a difference between the two. You could say, well, I'll compute the characteristic polynomial, something like that. And that would probably work here. It probably had different characteristic polynomials. I didn't bother figuring it out. But if instead of having seven vertices, these graphs had 1,000 vertices, I could come up with two graphs that have the same characteristic polynomial, but they're not isomorphic. Just about any other property you can possibly think of. Somebody who works on this kind of stuff spent a long time and come up with a counterexample. So, in fact, we don't know. Don't know if this problem is in NP or not. Most people would conjecture it is. Most people would actually probably conjecture that graph isomorphism is in P, and we just don't know how to show that. But the point is, we don't know. If you want to be convinced that these two graphs are not isomorphic, I mean, one way to do it is to see that over here, if you remove this edge between 2 and 5, you'd get two disconnected graphs. And over here, there's no edge that you could remove to get two disconnected graphs. That's just a particular property that was designed for these two graphs. And no matter what property you choose, somebody else is going to come up with a counterexample that foils that scheme. Question? Oh, I mean, I guess that there's some kind of evidence based on some sort of hardness assumption having to do with circuits and de-randomization, and don't really know it off the top of my head. But there's some sort of plausible condition that shows, that suggests this is true. The fact that graph isomorphism is probably in P is something that I wouldn't be able to convince you of, but people who work in graph theory would, that there should be graph invariants, things that are invariant under permutations that can be computed efficiently, that should tell you whether or not two graphs are isomorphic or not. In practice, it's very easy to solve the problem.
Okay, so in practice there are
usually easy ways to... Yeah, I mean, usually if you do some condition, you know, the characteristic polynomial is not a good one, but if you say, well, I'll write down the adjacency matrix and I'll change all the off-diagonal zeros to x's and all the off-diagonal ones to y's, and now I compute the characteristic polynomial of this thing as sort of some multivariate polynomial, that's pretty good. I mean, you have to go to a pretty high degree before you get a counterexample. So let's combine that with something else, or let's think about some physical process involving these graphs. I don't work on this problem, but from what I understand, there are algorithms that people can write down, and they probably work. And nobody's ever going to prove it. Well, somebody will eventually prove it, prove that they work. That's my understanding. But I don't specialize in this problem. So let me see if I understand the question. Maybe you're asking me to verify the claim that we do not know of an algorithm that will test isomorphism. That's correct. We do not have an algorithm that we can prove runs in polynomial time and solves the graph isomorphism problem. It is not, well, we don't know if it's NP hard. We don't even know if NP is different from P. Under reasonable complexity theoretic assumptions, graph isomorphism is not an NP complete problem. We can't prove that either. But if graph isomorphism was NP complete, then that would imply other things that we just don't think are true and that I won't get into because it's sort of outside of the scope of the talk, but we don't think it's NP complete. Okay, and I'm going to mention just one thing here before the end, because after we come back, we can talk about the quantum version of this. I just want to quickly mention that there is a class called MA, which is almost exactly the same as NP, and the only difference is that this verification procedure here is probabilistic. Nothing else is different. Same idea. You give a proof, and you verify that proof, but you're allowed to use randomness. That class is called MA. But conceptually, there's not really any difference between that and NP. It's just the use of randomness to do the verification. And we're left with this picture now of all these problems. Over here, NP and MA, these classes I just defined, they have these relations. NP is, of course, contained in MA trivially. BPP is contained in MA trivially. MA also happens to be contained in PP. This class PP is huge. You do lots of simulations in unbounded error, including simulating MA or solving MA problems. So we're at 10 o'clock now, so we should take a break. And when we come back, I'll talk about the quantum version of these things. So I don't know what time we're supposed to come back. Anybody has a schedule? Okay, so we have 30 minutes.